We live in the world, which is headed and run by the prince of the power of the air. But we live by the Spirit, discerning the times. For he who is spiritual discerns all things. Sharpen your discernment. Build your faith. Listen to the Word and World Team. Minister the Word of God through conversational theology, piercing the darkness of this present evil age.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
Well, welcome. This is Hampton Keithley and Bob Brandon, and we are continuing our review of chapter one of Evolution Achilles Heels. How are you today, Bob?
It's bright and early where I am, Hampton. The sun's not even up, and I'm in the dreary city. There's a lot of fog this morning. I'm in the dreary city of Denver, and I think the fog is related to the football game last night, because the Broncos just looked terrible.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I'm not losing any sleep over that. I'm not a Bronco fan, but ooh, they look bad.
Well, the first year that we lived in Colorado, 2015, I'm not a big football fan. And the question I always have to ask when I go to the Super Bowl party is, who's playing?
I don't even think I'd let you in the door of my house that you said.
So I walked into the Super Bowl party and it was, who's playing? And they go, well, Denver and the Patriots. And I'm like, well, I guess I should be for Denver since I'm in Colorado now.
They won that one you're referring to, I think, not the Patriots, but it was somebody else.
I thought it was always the Patriots.
No, I forget. Peyton Manning was the quarterback when they won. I forget. But anyway, Denver spent almost $250 million on this quarterback, Russell Wilson. And he's not doing very well. So anyway, here's what I'm excited about. Not our weather, certainly not football. My team's no good either. But this evolution stuff is so critical, Hampton. We've pointed it out before. I want to, you know, go through all the chapters of this book in somewhat painstaking detail, so that it really sinks in to our listeners, we did not evolve. Evolution did not happen, and it doesn't happen with any of the organisms. Yes, there is adaptation, no question. That's not a problem for a Christian worldview to believe that. But there's not evolution in the sense of origins, like where we came from, how we got here. It fails. Evolution as a theory fails everywhere you can test it. The only place it exists is in theory. When you can say, oh, over hundreds of millions of years, small changes added up to big changes. But there's actually no evidence for that. And things stay within their created kinds.
Right.
So anyway, I just want to hammer that home in detail and all the different subjects that pertain to that. For instance, let me just read the table of contents of this book we're going through. It's a good book. So chapter one, which is what we're in right now, natural selection. Chapter two, genetics and DNA. Chapter three, the origin of life. Chapter four, the fossil record. Oh boy, won't people be surprised what we're going to read there. Number five, the geologic record. Number 6, radiometric dating. Number 7, cosmology. And number 8, you know, these are chapter numbers, ethics and morality. But we'll detail all this. Every one of those subjects, evolution comes up severely lacking. And a question arises before we even get into the second half of our chapter today. So why do people still hold to it? And not even just hold to it. It's the dominant paradigm, the dominant worldview of Western culture. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes.
So how could this thing become dominant when it fails at every turn?
Because they don't like the alternative.
Well, I think that's exactly right. One way you could say it is, you know, there's only two games in town. One is evolution. The other game starts like this. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, right? So if you don't believe one, you're sort of forced to the other. And they don't want that. So they'll maintain evolution in the just flying in the face of every fact. Remember, you know, another thing to point out as we review some of this stuff before we get moving forward, there's good science and there's bad science. That was part of our core beliefs, right? The trouble with science is it's done by human beings, and human beings have worldviews. And the first thing a person will do for their worldview is lie.
Right.
So that's what you see as evolution is propounded across our culture. They're lying. They don't have this data that supports their case. All the data supports creation, all of it.
Yeah.
So I know that just sounds so bold, and it sounds like, you know, me, the non-scientist, criticizing the scientific community. But I stand by my words. And we'll read and see, right?
Okay.
So how about we start with this section called Evolution Should Be Seen in Microbes, If Anywhere. Here's the significance of this section. Evolution escapes criticism by proposing just massive spans of time, right? Man, it took mankind hundreds of millions of years to get here from an ape species or something. But it's always presented in such large chunks of time that there's no way to really test that, except microbes reproduce at a phenomenal rate. So whereas it takes 40 years or so for a human generation, or say 20 years for a human generation, you know, to reproduce, a microbe can reproduce in minutes almost.
Right.
Right. So if you study huge populations of microbes, you can get the equivalent of, you know, the human years pretty quickly, you know, within 10, 20 years. You can get thousands and thousands and thousands of generations. Right. So you should be able to see evolution there. On top of that, compared to a human being, a microbe is much simpler. I almost don't like saying that, because even a single-celled organism is incredibly complex.
Right.
Right.
We talked about in the first part of the chapter, I guess.
Yeah, very good. So that they are complex organisms, but not nearly like we are. You know, they don't have the systems we have. So it should be easier to evolve, and they evolve, then they reproduce quickly. So you can really test this theory with microbes. So let's read about that, because that's been done. And, you know, our listeners may never have heard about this study. Gee, I wonder why. I wonder why the scientific community would not be posting this on every website and every news article. But here we go. If evolution were to be observed anywhere, it should be in microbes. Many species of bacteria were first identified and named in the late 1800s, and yet they still have the same identifying characteristics today. So in 200 years, you haven't gotten any evolution in those simplest of organisms. One tendency in bacteria that seems to fly in the face of upward evolution, which would involve gain of a new genes, is the tendency towards deletion of genes. This is particularly so in obligate parasites and microbes in culture, where many genes in the original form are no longer necessary for survival, and these tend to be lost by deletion. So here, let's dive into this study. In 1988, Dr. Richard Lenski at Michigan State University founded 12 cultures of E. coli and grew them in his laboratory generation after generation for 20 years.
But you can't leave out his comment. In parentheses, he says he deserves marks for persistence.
Yeah, 20 years of looking at E. coli. Okay. The culture medium contained some glucose, but lots more citrate. So once the microbes consumed the glucose, they would continue to grow only if they could evolve some way of using citrate. So the way he has set this up is, you know, to almost force evolution to happen.
Right.
So that's fine. Good test. Let's see what the results he got. Lenski expected to quickly see evolution in action. This was an appropriate expectation for one who believes in evolution, because bacteria reproduce quickly and can have huge populations. As in this case, they can also sustain higher mutation rates than organisms with much larger genomes, such as vertebrates like us. All of this adds up, according to neo-Darwinism, to almost certainty of seeing lots of evolution happen in real time, instead of imagining it all happening in the unobservable past. With the short generation times, in 20 years, this had amounted to some 44,000 generations, equivalent to some million years of generations of a human population. However, the evolutionary opportunities for humans would be far, far less due to the small population numbers limiting the number of mutational possibilities and the much larger and much more complex genome, which cannot sustain a similar mutation rate without error catastrophe. Also, sexual reproduction means that there's a significant chance of failing to pass on a beneficial mutation. After many years of no result, Lenski seemed to have given up on evolution in the lab and resorted to computer modeling of evolution with a computer program called Evita. Indeed, Lenski had good reason to abandon hope. He had calculated that all possible simple mutations must have occurred several times over, but without any addition of even a simple adaptive trait. But then, with great fanfare, they announced that one of their 12 strains had acquired the ability to use citrate by the 31,500 generation. Hey, so let's pause there for a second. They're all excited. Oh, we've got it. The thing evolved such that it could now use citrate. Well, let's read further. Now, E. coli can already digest citrate under anaerobic conditions, and all that has to happen for it to utilize it under aerobic conditions is to break the mechanism that suppresses citrate uptake in the presence of oxygen. I speculated this in 2008. It's much easier to break something than to make something. And evolution has a poor track record of making anything, as we've seen. Let me pause there. Remember, in the core theory of evolution, it's about origins and it's about creating things, not breaking things. Right? So this bacteria, E. coli, hasn't created anything. It didn't grow an arm. It didn't grow an eye. It didn't grow a new chemical system. All it did was break something that allowed it to now use citrate. But it could already do that in anaerobic situations. So anyway, let me read on. Lenski's lab subsequently found the mutations responsible for this novel ability, published in 2012. Citrate is taken into the cell by a transporter protein. This protein is specified by the citrate transporter gene, CIT-T, which is normally turned off in the presence of oxygen. Very close to the CIT-T gene are genes that have a promoter that turns on those genes in the presence of oxygen. A single mutation resulted in the duplication of the promoter to a position that turned on the CIT-T gene so that the citrate transporter protein was now produced in the presence of oxygen. Further mutations duplicated CIT-T, resulting in more of the citrate transporter being manufactured so that more citrate was taken up. As I suspected, as a creationist biologist, something was broken. The mechanism that suppressed CIT-T in the presence of oxygen. Mutations did not create a new gene or even a new promoter. They just copied and pasted what was already there in the bacterium's genome, in the process producing a bacterium that could no longer turn off the CIT-T gene in the presence of oxygen. Note that away from the artificial environment of the lab, these bacteria would be maladapted, because production of a transporter protein when it was not needed would be wasteful. This is consistent with the analysis of molecular biologists. Here's our favorite guy, Hampton, Dr. Michael Behe, looking at another microbe with vast populations of organisms, the malaria parasite, Plasmodium. It has developed resistance to multiple anti-malarial drugs, and humans have developed some measure of resistance to it. Behe shows that all the causes of adaptation in both Plasmodium and humans are due to breaking things, not creating new complex features. Then he goes in to explain all that. I have that book, of course. That's Behe's The Edge of Evolution. I don't have it in my library because I give this stuff out to friends and I never get them back. but I remember reading that book and it just really impressed me. The most common way for species to adapt is by breaking something. And it can be beneficial to fit more closely into a niche. But what happens when that happens is you can't back out. You can't then create something and go to another niche.
If you turn this E. coli loose in the wild, it would die.
Yep, that's right. So The existence of databases of mutations that cause human disease underlines the wrecking that mutations do. For example, as of October 2011, online Mendelian Inheritance in Man listed 2,665 genes with one or more mutations that are known to cause disease. Public health authorities are concerned about exposure of people to mutagens and ionizing radiation because of mutations. Because the mutations they cause will cause disease, not X-Men, right? Like you don't get better vision. You don't get bigger muscles. You don't get, you know, Wolverine kind of abilities through mutations. You die through mutations.
You said earlier there's science and there's bad science. Another way of saying it maybe is there's science and there's science fiction.
That's a good insight. So a little two more paragraphs and we'll finish out this. The results of mutation breeding and mutations in microbes underlie once again that random changes, that is mutations, do not create the needed genetic specifications to transform simpler organisms into more complex ones with new traits that require additional DNA specifications. Nevertheless, mutations of one form or another are the only mechanism for evolutionists to explain the almost incomprehensible quantities of genetic information in the biosphere. Is there change over time? Yes. Changes that caused microbes to become microbiologists? No. It just doesn't add up. So, you know, that whole experiment by Lenski, you'll never see that reported in, you know, mainstream outlets. Even though you had the equivalent of, you know, 44,000 generations of reproduction, a single-celled organism, essentially.
And one mutation.
Yeah, right.
Caused something to survive was lost information or whatever.
Exactly. And it already had that ability, right? That was already in its genome. It didn't add a gene. It just broke something that was already there. So failed. It failed at that point. What's the next part you want to read, Hampton?
Well, the next section is about mutation rates. Evolutionists assumed on the basis of population genetics and their assumptions about the time frame and the process of evolution that the mutation rate in organisms is quite low, on the order of one per individual per generation or less. And then down below that, the next paragraph says, however, in recent years, the mutation rate has been measured and it is at least 50-fold higher than had been assumed.
Mm-hmm.
Evolutionary ideology. And this creates a huge problem for the whole idea. And Dr. John Sanford, remember last week I said there was a guy who studied mutations and the degeneration of humans and concluded that the species couldn't be more than about 6,000 years old?
Yeah.
And so that blew his mind and he became a Christian?
Yeah.
I think this is the guy, Dr. Sanford.
Yeah.
Because I looked him up after our last talk, and he is a Christian. So, anyway.
Yeah. Let me read another key paragraph out of that section. A process that steadily degrades a genome cannot produce a better organism in the long run. Sanford's analysis is devastating to the evolutionary paradigm. It's hard to see how it could be defended in the light of his critical analysis. And coming from such a high-profile geneticist, it cannot be lightly dismissed. So, yeah. Then you get another section. The next one is on sticklebacks. You ever heard of that kind of fish?
I have not.
So you remember reading this section. It's often held up as the epitome of evolution, like saltwater, because there's saltwater sticklebacks and there's freshwater sticklebacks. And the saltwater sticklebacks swim up the rivers, you know, to reproduce, almost like a salmon does. And eventually, like the saltwater guys turned into the freshwater guys. That's how it's portrayed as evolution happening, right? They developed a new ability to live in freshwater as opposed to saltwater. But when you go through, it's, by the way, let me just point out the obvious. It's still a stickleback. Okay.
Right.
Either way you look at it, it's still a stickleback. But he goes through pages of detail. So I'm just going to summarize it because that would really be painstaking. But this evidence is available to anybody who wants to look. The way a like saltwater stickleback morphs into a freshwater is it changes its morphology some. So it's in the freshwater, it doesn't have the same predators that it does in saltwater. So having a stickleback is not really helpful to it. So those went away. The stickleback, you know, the spines that are sticking up went away in freshwater. And so they said, see, that's proof of evolution. Well, what happened is just like with the E. coli, the mechanism for creating the stickleback morphology was broken. It didn't add any more information. It broke the existing information. In other words, there was a deleterious mutation that happened to be beneficial in this case, but it never changed a stickleback into anything else. It's just another false paradigm that's held up to the populace is here. See, this proves evolution. It doesn't prove anything. It just proves what the creationist is saying, really. Right. It doesn't prove what then. So
I want to back up to Sanford one more time.
Sure.
He made a list of problems related to this degeneration issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it says that mutations arise faster than selection can eliminate them. Number one. Number two, mutations are overwhelmingly too subtle to be selectable.
Yeah.
Three, biological noise and survival of the luckiest overwhelm selection.
Uh-huh.
Maybe a golf analogy is appropriate there. If you can't ever hit the green with your, you know, approach shot, I mean, one time you hit a tree and it goes in the hole.
Yeah. Yeah, my style.
You're not going to score very well.
Yeah, that's my approach.
Bad mutations are often physically linked to good mutations so that they cannot be separated in inheritance. To get rid of the bad and keep the good. The result is that all higher genomes must clearly degenerate.
Yeah.
So that I just felt like that.
Summarized.
That degeneration, yes, there are changes, but the number of bad ones so outweigh the good ones that we're going downhill.
Yeah. So species go extinct, right?
Right.
And so when you read that in a newspaper, they're going to say it went extinct because of climate change. It didn't. It went extinct because of mutation. And mutation is 99% deleterious. It's not helpful. And we've been over that illustration before. Like you ask any mother that's pregnant and you do an amniocentesis. And you say, you know what, your baby has a mutation. They're not happy.
Right.
They instantly, in their gut, no pun intended, know that's not going to be good. So you get a crazy theory with a crazy mechanism. So let's move on to epigenetics, interferes with natural selection, so that people have at least a rudimentary grasp of epigenetics. Let me explain it just briefly, and then we'll read some of that section. So when you're thinking of DNA, right, our four base nucleotides that end up, you know, forming a spiral staircase. Mm-hmm. That's what we have in our mind, right? That's actually not how that exists in your body. Although you do have that form, you have the spiral staircase form, and you have those four base pairs of nucleotides, but that is surrounded by a whole web, an intense web, by the way, of material that they call epigenetics. And that has profound effects on how your genetics are expressed. So that's a critical field. Remember the concept of Darwin's black box, you know, before they knew any of the biochemistry of this stuff, you could maybe say, well, you know, children don't look exactly like their parents. So maybe over thousands of generations or millions, you know, you could get change such that new species could arise. But then they found out, oh, here's what a gene is. And you got down to the spiral staircase, you know, with the four nucleotides. But now, I don't know how long this has been, maybe the last 20, 30 years. Now you have epigenetics on top of that, that it's much more complex than what you thought. One way to explain it is, you know, when you're looking at something in 2D, you get two dimensions, you get a certain perspective. But when you look at it in three dimensions, it instantly becomes much more complex. And that's the way to explain this. It's almost like DNA is 2D and epigenetics is 3D. It greatly complicates all the factors, which makes evolution not possible, right? When you just have four nucleotides, yeah, you could switch some of those out and create a change, probably deleterious, but maybe helpful. But you put a 3D function in there, there's no way you can get the kind of changes you want to create a new organism. I mean, there's no way. So let me just read some of that so people know what we're talking about. Then, Hampton, we'll get to the chimp thing. Okay. I can't wait to get to the chimps. Anyway, discovery of epigenetics in recent times has added another problem for natural selection. Epigenetics refers to the modification of gene activity, mainly via the attachment of methyl, that's CH3 for our chemists out there, groups to specify nucleotides in DNA. The process is called methylation. The bulky methyl group blocks the transcription machinery, RNA polymerase, so a methylated gene does not produce any protein product. It's silenced, and so on. So anyway, they go on throughout that section to explain how this makes everything so much more complex. So it's a relatively new field, but it's not good news for evolution. So I just wanted to put that out there for our listeners to know that epigenetics does not support the case for evolution. In fact, it makes it much harder to be considered as a paradigm. So how about we move on to the chimps? I love this one. Are you ready?
Well, let's wait. Do you think natural selection is too slow?
Yeah, that's the section this is in.
Okay, is that where we're going? Okay.
Yeah. So let me read this paragraph and we'll comment as we go. Imagine a population of 100,000 apes. Okay, you got that in your mind?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The supposed progenitors of humans. Suppose that a male and female both received a mutation so beneficial that they outsurvived everyone else. All the rest of the population died out, all 99,998 of them. And then the surviving pair had enough offspring to replenish the population in one generation. Okay, so
I'm just wondering about the chances of those two that got the same beneficial mutation got married out of 100,000 apes.
Yeah, so
kids.
So the chance of that is minuscule at best. Okay, but we'll grant it for the sake of the illustration.
Okay,
so we're already granting, 99% error. We're just going, okay, we'll just push that to the side. So imagine 100,000 apes, all of them but two die, and the two have 99,998 children. Okay? So none of this is actually possible, but if it were, let's read on. And then, and this repeated every generation. So it's not like this just happened once. This happened every generation for 10 million years. This unbelievable, completely impossible scenario went on for 10 million years. More than the supposed time since the last common ancestor of human and chimps. That would mean that 500,000 beneficial mutations could be added to the population. Even with this completely unrealistic scenario, which maximizes evolutionary progress, only about 0.02% of the human genome could be generated. Considering that the difference between the DNA of a human and a chimp, our supposed closest living relative, is at least 5% or 150 million bases, evolution has an obvious problem in explaining the origin of the genetic information in a creature such as a human. This is where the idea of junk DNA originated, which evolutionists realization that natural selection could not create enough DNA, so the vast majority must be non-functional. But see, even in that really impractical, there's no way that could have happened. But even if that did, you would not have produced a human being.
Right.
See, at every turn, evolution is defeated when you really look at it. And I think what most people do, and I'm going to switch into coach mode, is they punt because they just say, well, I'm not a scientist. Those guys are really smart. So, whatever they say, I'm going to have to roll with that. Don't do that. Don't punt. Open up the books. Dive in and critically read what they're saying, because evolution fails at every turn. There's never specifics given. There are always, over 10 million years, which you can't check.
Right.
Right. Right. This is what happened. It's just like a bad magician on a stage trying to do a trick. So anyway, how about if we wrap up this chapter and set the table for the next one? You ready for that? Or do you have other comments? Okay. So last little section. Does natural selection work at all? Well, it seems to in some situations, as we've seen in some examples, but it's overplayed. Some of the classic examples of natural selection, such as the peacock's tail, which Darwin supposed was created by the preference of females for males with showy tails, have turned out to be baseless, just so stories. And once again, even if the story of selection had held up with experimental testing, the story didn't explain the origin of the tail. Only possibly its maintenance, natural selection being a conservative force, was originally envisaged by the 19th century special creationist Blythe. Mutations and natural selection are clearly inadequate as a mechanism for the GTE. That stands for General Theory of Evolution, right? Mutations cannot explain the origin of anything. The modern explosion in molecular biology has only added to the case against evolution as a viable explanation for the diversity of life on Earth. The next chapter will explore what lies behind evolutionary theory, the field of genetics, and how modern discoveries in genetics render the idea of evolution quite untenable. So that's what we'll look at in the next chapter. Any closing comments, Hampton?
Well, he said something about the just so stories.
Mm-hmm.
I remember reading, well, that's first of all, a reference, allusion, whatever, to Rudyard Kipling's How the Zebra Got Its Stripes or How the Leopard Got Its Spots.
Mm-hmm.
So those are kind of kids' fairy tales. I don't know if that's the right word, but
yeah.
For how those things came about. I remember reading some evolutionists saying that we believe in these just so stories because we can't allow a divine foot in the door.
Correct.
Motivation.
Yep. And now let's back out of this just for a second, and we'll wrap up maybe with this thought. So again, the reason to press this issue into such minute detail is because it's the dominant paradigm in our culture. And here's how dominant paradigms affect things. If I'm right in what I think is happening with like the COVID-19 stuff, then there are people who are actually trying to, you could say, cull the herd. They're trying to reduce the human population. How sick do you have to be to do that? To kill millions of people on purpose? Well, if you start with this paradigm, there is no God, and I will never give an account for this, right? You can see how that would happen. You could see how the elites, right? That's what they would consider themselves, with billions of dollars, would perceive that our planet's overpopulated. It's not. But you could see how they would perceive that and want to reduce the population. Of course, they're not going to reduce themselves, right? It's going to be others that they reduce. And I'm almost certain that's what's going on. And they're using, quote, science, whose dominant paradigm is evolution, to do all that. They see our genetic code as almost exactly like a computer code. I mean, it doesn't speak of a creator to them. It just speaks of something they can manipulate in a lab.
Yeah, I was reading we skipped it in this chapter, but he talked, said something about genetic modification, and that kind of made me think about GMO,
right?
GMO corn, for example. And so, you know, scientists figured out how to reduce the phytic acid in corn because that kept the animals, humans, pigs, whatever, from processing iron and zinc. And so if you just fed these animals corn, then they got weak bones, they needed a more varied diet. They had extra fat and weak bones and stuff. So they genetically modify the corn to get rid of the phytic acid. And then those that eat that kind of corn can process the minerals. And so they end up being healthier. But, you know, so some of that stuff, the thing that I thought was, you know, this takes a brilliant mind to understand and, you know, work through these issues. This doesn't just happen.
Right.
You know, which is, you know, more in line with, you know, God creating all of this complex stuff.
Correct. Yeah. I just wanted to reemphasize, you know, that this is just a crucial subject.
It is.
For everybody to work through in their mind and have clearly settled. As a Christian, I've said this before, I've never come across data, reality, any form of reality that threatened my Christian worldview. In fact, I've been supported every time I've dived into a subject.
Yeah.
So, and what happens to your faith then is you're much more confident in speaking it, right? You're much more confident in sharing your faith once you've worked through all the issues and you're able to present the faith in a more gentle, I'm still working on that, in a convincing way. So let's be adults in God's kingdom, not children that just punt in the areas of science.
Very good.
All right, champ.
I'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Therefore, I exhort you, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a sacrifice, alive, holy, and pleasing to God, which is your reasonable service. Do not be conformed to this present world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may test and approve what is the will of God, what is good and well-pleasing and perfect.